Hi, this is Mark Talbot. I post his ult in a 20-foot radius.
Hi, this is Derek Myers. I post as Amaron at DungeonsMaster.com. And welcome to our podcast, Recounting Encounters.
A show where we talk about what happened at D&D Encounters this week. Hey everybody, and welcome to D&D Encounters, Against the Cult of Chaos, Season 12, Session 3. We have a lot to talk about this week. Once again, joining us is Craig. And how you doing, Derek? How you doing, Craig?
Pretty good. How about you?
Doing well.
I'm super pumped. I had such a great night at Encounters tonight. I can't wait to talk about it.
Sounds good. Well, then start.
Okay.
All right. So, let's go.
As we've said before, this encounter is not linear. So although it is the third week of this season, there's a very good chance that what I did this week is different than what you did this week. And as we find out, all three of us played three different encounters this week. And there's a very good chance that the encounter I did, many of the other groups have not done yet. So if you're one of those players that can't separate player knowledge from character knowledge, as much as it pains me to say this, you may want to put this podcast on hold until you've had a chance to complete all the encounters. So with that being said,
with very different our encounters also had very different endings compared to the ones that we've already played, like the ones that we all played similarly. It's been pretty interesting.
Yes, absolutely. Indeed. So my group last week, they did the Moat House, which in the adventure itself is the actual second one in if you play it in order. This week we ended up doing the Caves of Chaos, which is the last one, the seventh one before the grand finale. So it's an interesting sort of situation for how we got from, you know, encounter two to encounter seven. So at the end of last week's encounter, they barely managed to defeat the bandits at the Moat House. They managed to take all of them alive, and they decided they were going to return them to the town because they seemed to think that there might be a reward for some or all of these bandits. Not to mention, they also had found all the supplies from Wendell's caravan that had been robbed. And the PCs didn't want to have to carry all that stuff. So they basically got all of the prisoners to carry all of Wendell's stuff, and they carted them back to town. So we started, that's where we picked things up this week. We had one brand new player with us who had never, ever played Dungeons & Dragons before. So we gave him a pre-generated character. We had a character, we had a player who was brand new last week, who used Fargrim, who unfortunately died a heroic death. This week, he made his own character. He made a barbarian, which is similar to Fargrim. So we had two new characters to the party, and we had three of our usual. So we had a party of five. They basically came back into town. They brought the prisoners right to the constable. And I just watched the movie City Slickers over the weekend, so I basically described the constable like Jack Palance from City Slickers. I'm like, he's this old, grizzled guy who's definitely spent some time on the road, and he's like a no-nonsense. And so that sort of put them in the right mindset, and they basically turned over the prisoners. And then I had the constable, you know, ask them for a report. He's like, hey, we're not going to put these prisoners on trial until after the election. We're electing a new mayor because there's one of the points of contention right now is how to deal with prisoners. Do we kill them? Do we send them away? Do we lock them up? So he's like, we're going to keep them in lockup for a couple of weeks, and we need you guys to give statements because we know adventurers have this habit of either leaving or getting killed. So the players spilled their guts. They told him everything that they found out, all the details. They didn't hold anything back. And so then the constable's like, well, you know, these two spies that you've learned about, they work at the trading post. You know, all we have to go on is the word of these bandits. So we don't know if that's actually correct or not. So we don't want to accuse them of anything yet. Maybe we should just bring them in for questioning. And so the characters were like, yeah, well, maybe we should do that. Maybe we should not. They weren't really sure. They were kind of hesitant. They didn't know if they wanted to follow up on that lead. So the constable suggested they go to the Golden Grain Inn. He's like, you know, it's almost lunchtime. Go there. He's like, a few of the locals have been outside. They saw you guys coming into town with all these prisoners. You're going to be hailed as heroes. You probably get a free lunch, which, of course, the PCs jumped all over that. They went and got their free lunch in the inn. And then Bertram was like, hailed them as heroes. Heroes don't pay for dinner. Heroes don't pay for drinks. Come on, guys. Like, tell us all about it. And so, of course, they repeated their story. We took out the bandits, rah, 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 we're great. And, of course, the locals were like, what happened to Fargrim? And they're like, oh, he died a hero's death. So they had to recount the tales of Fargrim's heroics. And so then, of course, Bertram's like, well, you know, you guys are already heroes. But if you want to be, like, superheroes, you should go out to the Caves of Chaos because there's some creepy stuff going on out there. And the constable had also echoed that. He's like, you know, if you guys aren't really up for questioning suspects, why don't you just go out and do what you're good at and kill monsters? The Caves of Chaos, all the monsters seem to be working together. Something's up.
Those aren't subtle hints or anything.
Yeah, so Bertram basically echoed that. He's like, you know, he goes, the bandits were a problem, but I think our biggest problem is these kobolds, goblins, orcs all working together. Something's up. Like, if you guys are these badasses that you're saying, you should go check that out. So then the heroes are like, yeah, we should totally do that. So off they went to the Caves of Chaos. Oh, no, they did, I had the constable come back. He goes, hey, I'm going to go question those two spies that the bandit told us about. You want to come with me? And they're like, no, we're going to the Caves of Chaos. We'll see you when we get back. So off to the caves they went. They met up with the ghost. Of course, they didn't know who he was at first, but they were smart enough not to fight him. They tried to talk him down, and then they realized who he was. And I made it very clear with the ghost. He's like, these caves, he goes, there's many caves here. There's many inhabitants. It's all the monsters, all the chaotic creatures. He goes, some reason they're all working together. He goes, they know you're here. They can see you right now. They've been watching you. He goes, they're going to come after you. Time is of the essence. You need to find this sword of chaos and then leave. You cannot possibly stand and fight against all of them. Go. And so the players are like, okay, shit, we got to get going. So they took off to the cave. And then one of the characters from last week was still very injured. She only had enough healing surges to bring herself up just above her bloodied value. Actually, I think she was right on her bloodied value, right on the number. And she had one healing surge left after that. So she's like, I'm going to stay outside the cave and climb a tree and hide. She's playing a pixie. She goes, meanwhile, you guys go in and see what's up. So now, based on the feedback Mark provided last week, Caves of Chaos, I decided not to have all the monsters come through the cave. I had some of the monsters coming from outside. So like when the orcs came, I had two come from inside and two come from outside. When the kobolds came, I had three come from inside and two come from outside. And that way it sort of forced the party to divide and split their focus. And it really worked well. I mean, the party got overrun pretty quick, but it was a lot of fun. I had a really good time doing it. One of the really interesting things is our party was very striker heavy. We had three outstanding strikers, and every round they hit something, and every round they were doing like 20 or more points of damage. But when it's a minion, it doesn't matter. And it became really apparent that the lack of a controller that could do blasts and bursts and the lack of a defender to lock down some monsters made a huge difference, and not in a good way. And we talked about this a minute ago. What do you think, guys? Like, do you find that this season, like, the balance of a party is making a huge difference?
Yes, absolutely.
I find especially, like we discussed earlier, I find that the encounters are so well designed now, and whether it be just with the monsters and the setting, that a well-balanced party is essential for these encounters.
Yeah, because I think every role can like really shine in these encounters. Whereas I think, you know, what we were talking about before, where you could have an all striker party and just kind of steamroll over everything. This time it feels like everyone's like, you can feel the value of your role, and pretty much every encounter that I've you know, either DM'd or played this season thus far.
Yeah, and I think that's a real compliment to the authors of this adventure. And I think to Wizards of the Coast, the people who run the public play, because this is something that I've written about in my blog post before, is a lot of the players that play with me and have been playing with me for a long time now, they love to play strikers. So we generally have a very striker-heavy party. Like one season, we had five strikers. And they just, Craig, to your point, they just steamrolled over it. I was doubling the monster's hit points every single week, and it didn't matter. They just crushed it. Mm-hmm. This season, you know, if you've got a party of nothing but strikers, you're not going to make it. The encounters are like, they're great encounters. They're designed very well. Like the one tonight is awesome. You just have wave after wave after wave of minions. And yeah, that's great that you can hit a guy and drop him with one hit. But when there's five of you and there's 20 minions on the board, you're going to, you know, sheer mechanics, you're not going to win.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So, so my group did really good. A couple of the guys did fall unconscious, but were revived by the leader. They did manage to find Otis in the cave, and they found he had the magic sword in him. And one of the characters, you know, at a very critical point in the battle, just decided, screw it, and pulled the sword right out of his wound, used it as a magic weapon, made use of the powers it provided. That, combined with a perfectly timed sleep spell from our wizard, on the ogre and a couple of the orcs what made all the difference. She rolled a natural 20 against the ogre. Now, unfortunately, sleep does no damage. You are slowed if you're hit, and then you get a save, and if you fail the secondary save, you fall asleep. So I kind of felt that it cheated her that she rolled this 20 and got nothing for it. So I said to the group, and believe me, the party needed all the help they could at that point. I said, you know what? Since you rolled a 20 and since this doesn't do damage, I'm going to say that the 20 applies a penalty to the monster saving throw. I think that's a fair trade-off. Because if this was an attack spell, you would have done, you know, assuming you had a magic implement, you'd do an extra 1d6. You'd do the maximum damage under normal circumstances with a crit. So, you know, the party sort of went, yeah, that sounds fair. So then the monster made the first save. He rolled an 11, which normally would save. But because I applied a penalty, boom, fell asleep. It provided the one round that they needed where the monster could not attack them because he was asleep. They managed to just get the hell out of there with Bertram. With Otis, with the magic sword. They took off. It was a very close fight. They were all bloodied by the end, some of them with only a couple of hit points, and they managed to get away. It was a ton of fun. We spent probably an hour at the beginning doing the role-playing in the town, and then the combat took about 90 minutes, and It was great. I had so much fun running it, and I think the players had a really good time as well. We had the one guy who was brand new tonight, one guy who was brand new from last week, and one girl who was brand new this week. So we had three players that had a combined 6 weeks of experience between them. And I asked them, I said, you guys all having fun? And they're like, oh, yeah, this is great. So I loved it. I had a great time.
It's funny, just to add to that, I noticed that you and Craig earlier tonight were saying, you know, you've done half an hour of role-playing, 45 minutes of role-playing, an hour of role-playing in town, all that kind of stuff. My party has not had any type of role-playing. For some reason, they've been falling on almost the exact path that they have to take to get to the next encounter. And it's kind of weird. It's a little disconcerting on my side, but I think it just shows how flexible and how non-linear this adventure really is this season.
Yeah. And I have to say, Derek, I really like what you did with the critical role on the on sleep, because that's, you're absolutely right. You know, it's an attack. If you're doing an attack role that does damage, then you're getting like some sort of, you know, benefit to it. So it kind of does feel like a cheat, especially when the party's struggling like they are. You get a 20, but it's just something that just provides a static effect, regardless of what you rolled, as long as you've, you know, hit their defense. So I thought that was a good thinking on your feet to give the monster that penalty to save.
I agree. You know what? That I was actually going to bring that up later in the podcast, but yeah, the whole critical hit thing is fantastic. A DM that can actually do that kind of stuff, and you know, you see the reward that came out of it. She says, oh yeah, critical, I hit him, yeah, but whoopee, but with your input you made the player feel very used or well used in the party, and that just does everything in itself, and I think that's great.
Well, yeah, and when she rolled the crit, it's like everybody cheered. Like it was critical. The party was like, this was a huge turning point for the adventure. At this point, this could have meant the difference. If the ogre had not fallen down, like it was doing like 20, 30 points with each hit, nobody had that many hit points. If it had managed to get into a choke point and lock the party down in the cave, it would have been done. Like, game over. The monster had almost 100 hit points and had taken no damage. So this was huge. She rolled a 20 and the table cheered like, bro, yeah. And we all high-fived. And then she sort of, yeah, it doesn't do any damage. And it's like, oh, so, yeah. You know, I'm glad that you guys think that I did the right call on that one. But it just, I felt that, like you said, it felt like such a cheat that it's like, oh, she's not getting any benefit for this 20. And I'm like, here, this is how I'm going to work it. So,
yeah, I mean, it seems very justifiable, and it doesn't feel like a pity. So they're like, okay, well, I'll give you something. Like, it makes complete sense, just sort of in like the scope of how combat works, right?
Yeah, yeah. No, I would definitely, you know, I'm kind of upset I never thought of this before, because we have a guy in our home game who uses controllers nonstop, and like there's a lot of controller powers that do no damage but are basically like this. They require saving throws. So I'm definitely going to continue to use this we'll call it a mechanic. I mean, you don't roll a crit that often, so I don't think it'll come into play very frequently, but it's definitely something I'm going to keep in the back of my mind the next time it does come up in play, because I'm sure it will. Now that it's happened once, watch, it'll happen like three times in the next month, and I'll be like, hey, I came up with this great idea, let's do this.
Yeah, for sure.
See, this is why you listen to the podcast, you listen to three DMs who do three different things, and you learn stuff. And the more you learn as a DM, or even as a player who wishes to become a DM, or as a player, period, the more you learn, the more you hear what other people have to say, the bigger your repertoire, more fun for the players, more fun for the DM.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
Indeed.
So, Craig, how did things go for you? You and I played together at the table. Yes. You ran, and then you played again at the other store at a different table. So
that's right, and the one I played too. Went. Yeah, so, all right, so basically the one that I ran was the second part to the Golden Grain encounter. However, it's not the second part. It's the second part only if you had not survived the previous encounter. And then the one that I actually played at... the following night was actually an encounter that none of us did tonight, which is the second part of the Moat House. But I'll start with the one that I DM'd. So basically the week before, just as a quick recap, we had the players that come into the Golden Grain Inn, and you know, Bertrand, as we know, is very enthusiastic about the players and about people having a good time at his bar. So they had a whole bunch of fun bar games to play, and you know, the players had kind of foiled their attempts to snuff them from the picture. So Bertrand eventually suggests that the players, you know, meet him in the basement because he knows that they're there to investigate some unusual happenings in Homelane. So he sends them down to the basement, but really it's an ambush. And unfortunately, the players weren't able to endure the onslaught and found themselves knocked unconscious. So we opened this week's session. Well, actually, we had a player who was there for the first week. So that was the introduction. You're coming to Homelane. Here's Sir Moonbrook, blah, 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 blah. He wasn't there for the second one. So I had to get him up to speed. So it made sense for me to, because he was actually investigating something in the first week, which is... Which one is it? Is it the Slumbering Dragon, the one where the guy with the big red hat comes and
yeah, that
or
was
Felix Hobb, I believe is his name is. Yeah, but anyway, he had an interaction with him where he said, hey, you know, we should really go adventuring together. It would be great. Blah 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 blah. And then the next week he wasn't there, so I never really followed up on it. However, on his return, I kind of had him at the very beginning as an aside. So, you know, while your friends were at the Golden Grain Inn, you were following up with Felix Hobb trying to find out, you know, what are we gonna do? We're going to go for an adventure. And eventually it led him to the Golden Grain Inn where he was to meet Felix later on. But when he got there, Bertrand, the bartender, had said, oh, you know, sorry, there's no one. Someone by that description was here, but, you know, he took off early. He said he had to go, he had some business out of town. He had to leave. So unfortunately, looks like you got stiffed, basically. So, you know, that led the player to be like, oh, you know, what can I do? But then Bertram's like, oh, if you'll excuse me, I have to go to the basement for a moment. Which, of course, as everyone knows, the other players, that's actually him going down to ambush the other PCs. So, yeah, so basically he overhears a scuffle, goes down to investigate, gets himself knocked out. So that kind of brought everyone back together. And you all awoke on a wooden raft, being ferried across an underground lake in the dark, but waking up with raging headaches, and there's Derek, not Derek the player, but Derek the NPC, taking you across the lake to have you turn into a mindless slaves of the reptile god. Now, at this point, the players don't really know what's happening. They're just waking up. They really have no idea what's happened, like why are they still alive kind of thing. So basically I had the guys wake up and realize that like they're in this underground sort of area. They don't know what's going on, and they're able to see that there's the guy from the fight earlier, you know, pushing the boat along, but they're able to get out of their binds. So I don't know, I can't remember who it was, but one of the players had decided he was going to very quickly dispatch the boat rider, because from the week before, this is the same character who they had actually injured. So he wasn't doing so hot himself. So he was already kind of weakened to begin with. So he was able to drop him in one hit, because basically that you know, bringing this PC in, he's not supposed to come in at full hit point. So I had him start at a quarter of his health. So
I like that. So sorry, let me jump in. Yeah. So I was one of the players in that. I thought that was really good that, because even though I'm the DM, I haven't read these. I didn't read that stream of adventure yet because I knew that my group wasn't there. So I wanted it to be a surprise for me as the player. Yeah. And I liked that. I read it after we played it. And Craig, I like that you had brought this guy in who was in the previous week's fight, who really wasn't supposed to be in this fight at all, and had him appear with the same amount of damage because we had hurt him quite badly in the week before, but we hadn't dropped him. So basically at this point, he was more or less a minion. Like pretty much, I assume almost any single hit that did reasonable damage would have dropped him, which is what happened. Exactly. And I thought that was a really good add-on for you because it was like when we woke up and we sort of saw him there, it was a face that we recognized and it was a face we immediately recognized as a bad guy. So we knew something is going on and it is definitely not good for us.
Yeah. And so, and I should back up a little bit too, just again, cause I know we talked about it a little bit last week, but this is the encounter where, you know, if you had actually beaten the encounter previously, you would have actually been going to a completely different location doing something else entirely. So this one is just a completely different encounter that is also, of course, accessible, but it would be approached from a different angle if it wasn't for the fact that they're being brought in as prisoners in this case. So anyway, they're being ferried across. They knock the boat rider out. And he's wearing some cult-like robes. So this is, I think, when the party hit a little bit of a snag, and there was a famous tweet that went out, I believe.
I'll read it here for our listening audience. If you don't already follow me on Twitter, you may want to, because I have this tendency to tweet the great quotes that come out of the game. And I basically said to the group, you know, as we contemplated a number of both good and bad ideas, I said to them, let's not do anything stupid. There'll be plenty of time for that after we roll initiative. And believe me, there was a lot of stupid things that happened after we rolled initiative.
Yeah, I mean, I think when the planning came time to plan, like, how are we going to approach this now? Because we don't really know what's on the other side. Yeah, I think you did bring the boat up, because there's a little bit of a wall where you're able to kind of sidle up around the side. And you rolled a great stealth and were able to see around the side that there's a giant reptilian beast that seems to be hypnotizing or doing something to a group of people that surrounds them. So that's what you saw, and basically no one could agree on how they were going to approach it. So we had, you know, half the party seemed to want to get out of the boat into the water because the water was clouded and dark enough that they could approach with relative stealth. But another one, I know we had another couple guys who wanted to just kind of come in, guns blazing, or at the very least come in out of sight in the boat, but just kind of pop up and boom, 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 start shooting away. So it took a little bit to get that plan finally in place, but I believe the final plan was, everyone was out of the boat except for one guy who laid in the boat. Is that right?
No, the one guy had the cloak on. The one guy put on the cloak because he was a melee only and no range attacks. The other five of us who were ranged were like, let's quietly get in the water, swim to an advantageous position, and then we can all just get up and shoot. And we're like, perfect. Until the first guy went. He got out of the boat, swam around the corner, and decided, I'm shooting now.
Yeah, he got right up at the. Yeah, he was the first one to go too, because he got right up and onto the shore, I believe, and just popped up and boom, the end.
Which was great for him, but bad for the rest of us.
It was too late then. At that point, the attention was drawn to the oncoming combat. So, surprise was basically blown at that point. It was a pretty good combat. Definitely, the reptile god is quite. Quite the damage dealer. So she's got a melee 2 tail swipe that did like 2d8 plus something. Anyway, it was a heavy hitter, but she also has not willpower that lets her do 2 basic attacks every turn, right? So she had a range attack that was also a heavy hitting one that would also slow you, but as well, when you got close enough, she could slap you with her tail and slide you out 3 squares. Now, the other thing to keep in mind too is that the terrain in this encounter is, I mean, it's all water, and then on the shore you have a lot of basically zombified people surrounding this Naga. So basically, it's nothing but difficult terrain around you.
It was awful. I mean, we had a lot of ranged attackers, which actually, you know, had we been an entire melee party, we would have got slaughtered because we wouldn't have been able to get close enough to do anything good. So the ranged attackers certainly gave us a little bit of an advantage. But the absence of a controller in this party made it a huge difference in the wrong way. Like, if we had had a strong controller in our group, this fight would have been over before it even started. But
well, too bad you didn't have a warden that could have locked down like 4 or 5 or 6 of them at a time, just kind of go right into the middle of everything.
Yeah,
and
I don't
just...
even think we had a defender. What did we have? We had 2 leaders and 3 strikers, I think. And yeah, one of the leaders was very combat oriented.
Yep. And I mean, like I said, the maneuverability was really pretty brutal. So there was a lot of repositioning of that boat to try and like allow room for like a charge or, you know, whatever. But I don't know. It was a lot of fun, especially when that Wraith got into the fight, because there's a Wraith that's hidden right up at the top, hiding in the water. Now, it's supposed to come out pretty like right once combat starts. I held the Wraith back for a little bit. I just wanted to you know, hold back and let these guys get up and right into the reptile god, and then kind of hit them from behind with a surprise attack. Now, the Wraith, unfortunately, has a pretty devastating attack where I believe the damage it put is a 2d6 plus something. But the real problem here is that it also steals a healing surge anytime it hits you. So, I mean, Derek comes in with, what, 2 healing surges left?
I had 2 surges, but as a druid, I could use a surge to summon my spiritual companion, which I planned to do, but because it's a melee companion, I needed to get next to the monster, which because of the terrain, I just couldn't do. So when I realized the monster took the surges, I'm like, uh-oh, this is going to totally change my tactics. If it drains all my surges before I can summon my creature, then I'm kind of screwed.
Well, and the problem with the Naga as well is that, you know, you get close to melee, she has, on her turn, she has 2 chances to slap you away, right? And the second problem is if you're hitting with ranged, she's surrounded by people that are basically making it difficult to hit. So she has a little bit of a bonus to her defenses when it's ranged. So it was a little bit of a struggle, but you guys were able to pull through with some sound tactics.
Eventually. And I mean, second week in a row for me playing that striker, you know, my character's a druid ranger hybrid. So I have twin strike as well as some of the druid powers. I'm using twin strike every time pretty much. And I'm rolling 2d10s on 2 hits plus the d6 quarry. And I'm rolling, you know, 1, 1, and 2 every round. I'm like, are you kidding me?
Yeah.
Like, I think I had the one good round where I rolled almost the max. And then that was it. Like, but you got the monster bloodied fast. We all did amazing damage early on, and then nobody could hit it. Nobody could do decent damage. It was silly.
Yeah, and she was able to keep herself kind of out of harm's reach too quite often. But another thing that I thought you guys actually did really well with was making use of that murky water.
Yes. Yeah, I know that a couple of us, myself and one of the other players, on our turn – when our turn was over, we just said, move action, I go underwater and hold my breath. And then that way, if the monsters wanted to try and shoot us, it was basically like shooting into a globe of darkness. So it helped their defenses.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
A couple of times the monsters did target us and missed. So that made a huge difference. And the one power that really helped us, I think it was the cleric. Is John playing a cleric or a bard? It did on a success. I'm pretty sure it was a daily. And on a hit, it reduces the damage dealt by the creature, and then he can sustain it. And right. I think he rolled like 7. And so every time the monster hit, it was 7 less damage. And like, we would have been toast without that.
Yeah. And another thing I liked, and I actually kind of held back on it for a little bit too, because I wanted to see how you would react to it. There's 2 characters that are hidden amongst all the prisoners that are held about her. There's 1 cultist and then 1 NPC who you might assume is a cultist when she makes her presence known. So again, just in interest of not wanting to spoil it where it's not necessary, but there's an NPC that's been mentioned a couple of times from the beginning that makes an appearance in this particular part. Now, this NPC is actually not one of the cultists, not part of this evil plot, is actually there for the, you know, quote unquote processing. However, there's also a cultist that's there, that's hiding amongst the prisoners, but is there to actually join in the fight later on. So having them pop up roughly around the same time, I kind of wanted to see, are these guys going to target both of them for attack or, you know, or what?
But you know what? I'm just thinking about this as a suggestion for when people run this later is, to your point, Greg, in retrospect, you should have used the same minis for both of them.
Yeah, no, you're right.
Because in my mind as a player, I see 2 minis that look the same and one of them shooting at me. I assume they're both bad guys and I shoot back.
However, I don't know if you noticed, but I did use an aggressive looking mini, though. I just wanted to have the differentiate because I used a hobgoblin. This one that's like dressed up with robes and like red robes. But
But the fact that the NPCs are supposed to be there for processing,
and
this other one is trying to masquerade as someone being processed, like, it would make sense that they might all be in the same kind of sacrificial robes. So you might not at first realize that they're not the same monster type. And I mean, I think that's kind of a dirty trick to play on the players, but you know, it might, especially if the party is having an easy sort of easy time with the combat, like, this is a way to potentially mess with them a little bit. Because, well, I mean, you know, it has repercussions on the rest of the adventure.
Yeah, exactly. And it kind of like fuels that role playing, you know, mentality of I shouldn't just shoot first, ask questions later kind of thing, right? Absolutely. But I mean, what it came down to in the end, though, the tactics were sound. The enemies were taken care of. But that's when you get into the part of the encounter that I thought was a little bit weaker. So I'm sure we'll probably talk a little more about these points later on, but basically there's sort of a quasi-skill challenge at the end, which is sort of your escape from the caverns. And it's just a series of events that you kind of have to go through, making checks along the way. But there wasn't really a whole lot of mechanical. There was a couple of cool things I liked about it, and there's a lot of role-playing sort of repercussions it could have, but it just kind of felt tacked on to me.
Yeah, no offense to you as the DM running it, but yeah, that was sort of my feeling as well, is the combat for us was as first level PCs doing this combat, it was a tough battle. We were in pretty bad shape. Like, we had already gone through two other fights, so most of us were out of surges. And then it was like, oh, by the way, here's this. It almost seemed like insult to injury. It's like, really, we got to waste our time doing this? And the fact that there were no significant repercussions to failing the checks along the way. I mean, yes, we lost some of the NPCs, which may or may not affect how other people react to us when we get back, but I don't know. It just didn't seem like a good use of our time, considering how many real-time minutes had already ticked away.
I agree. Because, I mean, that was a pretty big fight, so you're bound to take a little longer with it anyway. Unless it's a wipe, of course. But I mean, if not, then, yeah, it's probably going to take a little bit longer. And, yeah, like I said, it felt kind of tacked on. And I think one thing I wish I would have done now, like in retrospect, was I wish I would have spent a little more time, maybe flesh it out a little more, or maybe add a little more meaning to it. But, you know, that would be my advice, I think, to anyone running it yet to come. That take a look at that, see if there's anything that you want to do that you can do to flesh it out. Because as written, I felt it kind of came off as it felt very tacked on.
Well, considering how good the combat part was, like, I thought the combat, the way it was set up, was really strong. I really enjoyed it. It was tough, don't get me wrong, but I really liked it. Like, again, most, you know, some weeks we go in and we're like, yeah, this was just a so-so week. This encounter, I think, was really well done. But yeah, the last part almost sort of took away from the greatness of the encounter.
So I know what I'll be taking away. I'm going to take a good look at it because that's what my party. Sorry, guys. My party's going to be running next week. And well, don't worry. The skill challenge won't be the same, guys.
Yeah,
yeah. I've got three of my players that actually listen to the podcast, so it's pretty cool.
Okay, that's good. Well, because like I said, that whole skill challenge bit again, it does feel kind of tacked on, and I think it's also sort of it felt a lot like the older sort of seasons of encounters where they would have sometimes a meaningless skill challenge as sort of like, okay, well, here's a little bit of role playing because we want to have a taste of role playing in here as well.
Could you add something like let's say, okay. Sure, the skill challenge is basically saying, okay, well, this is what you got to do to get out of the caves. Could you basically say that a bunch of the cultists heard the dying screams of the Naga or whatever like that, and then all of a sudden it's basically a skill challenge where you're fighting against time and the reptile god cult or some of the other minions and stuff like that are actually chasing you, and since you're down so much in surges already, that basically, you know, you've got to chase your way out. Could you modify it that way? Would that be a...
No, I think that is completely possible, especially considering the cultists get there via, like, a teleportation spell in the basement of the Temple of the Lawbringer, so...
Right.
It completely makes sense to have something like that happen. But like I said, at the time, I didn't... When you know, reading through it, I kind of thought it might be a little bit tough to make it kind of feel like it flows well or feels very organic, so... Now, after having run it, now I know I wish I spent a little more time on that or had adjusted that a little more to be something of more substance than what it was.
Right.
I think for me that the my critique or my feedback of it is I didn't necessarily have a problem with the mechanics of it. It was more just I didn't really feel there was anything bad that would happen if I failed. Like in combat, if it's bad, you get killed or you have to waste surges. But at this point, it was like, oh, okay. Yeah, some rocks fall on you, you get hurt. Well, I'm out of surges anyway. Like it didn't really seem to have any meaning. And I mean, I know that Craig, you made a point of saying like, you know, as you fail checks, I think there was something like 10 or 12 NPCs that we were trying to rescue.
Right.
It's like a couple of them get crushed or they fall behind or you're not able to motivate them. They keep resting and you have to leave them behind. I think what needs to be maybe a little more clear is, as these characters die, the people who survive start to blame the heroes. Like, if you guys had done a better job, these people wouldn't have died. And then that negativity maybe needs to carry over into the next set of encounters. So when we go back to the town, we're not, you know, it's not rah, rah, the heroes are here. It's like those friggin' guys, it's because of them that, you know, Joe and Steve got killed. And it's like, whoa, 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 what are you talking about? I saved everybody else. It's like, yeah, but those two guys were like pillars of the community and your flub screwed things up.
Speaking of that, there are three named NPCs that are part of this whole group, and they're the last three that will die. So if you end up losing all the villagers, then you lose these three other ones that would tie into other storylines if you had already discussed or knew anything about them. In this case, the party has not, you know, heard anything about two of them at the very least.
Oh, okay.
Do you know what I mean? So
yeah, no, I absolutely do. I mean, I've read through the village, so I have a pretty good idea of what you're talking about. But I think maybe just as a DM, when I get around to running that, you know, I think what I'll try and do is convey just the, you know, these aren't just nameless minions that you're never going to hear from. Right. Like these are, for all intents and purposes, these are real people in this town. And if you're going to be here for any length of time, if these people don't all make it through, the rest of them are not going to be happy.
Yeah. Because I mean, I think the real negative thing that you have to look out for with this one is that, or like the outcome for the PCs, I should say, sorry, is that, like they'll come back to town and they'll be like, oh, you know, these guys aren't very good. They let a whole bunch of us die, but it didn't really color anything else beyond that.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to take a look at it and modify it. I'm going to find a way. I think I'll add as part of the skill challenge where if the PCs get a success, then they might have a chance to maybe revive one of them. Like, you know, one of their healing surges or something like that.
Yeah. And I mean, like I said,
I think it also depends on. Yeah, I think it also depends on where your group is. Like with our group, this was the end of the third encounter. And basically we all knew we're getting an extended rest after this. So we were depleted of everything. If your group comes to this, say in week four, you're going to have full everything and you're going to be, I assume you'll have just leveled. So you're going to have a different repertoire of resources at your disposal. And so you may do things differently, losing a surge from a collapse of the rocks or, you know, not quite making the chasm jump and falling down and losing a surge can be more detrimental because it's like, geez, I still got to go through two more full encounters. Like if I lose three surges in this stupid skill challenge, that's a big deal to me. So maybe that's what's coloring my judgment a little bit is just happened.
But this encounter is like, it's very much geared to be like the last encounter before you have an extended rest. Because it can be a pretty tough combat and you have to burn through a couple of scenarios to get to it at the very least. Right.
So yeah. Yeah, exactly.
But in this case, they'll be coming in with lower resources anyway because my party's pretty much knocked out and pretty much going to be on the raft to start off with.
Yeah.
So we'll have to see how that pans out.
Indeed.
Sorry, if you're done, Craig. Mark, why don't you tell us about yours before Craig jumps in with his other table?
Well, mine was very, very simple. So we got the sword at the cult at the Caves of Chaos. We headed back to town, and essentially, Mr. Hommel, the ghost, had basically told the party, go to the moat house, we know that one of the relics is there. So, we took a little sidetrack, I guess I made my intentions unclear. We went back to the Temple of the Lawbringer. The party wanted to see whether or not Sir Moonbrook had said anything at this point, to see if Canon Isidae was back, and Canon Isidae wasn't back. So, all of a sudden, one of the party members said, hey, where is Canon Isidae? And I kind of said, Canon Isidae is out. She's still out. Well, where is she? I said, well, she went up to Emery Meadows. And I'm just thinking of this because I know, you know, the previous adventures. And they said, okay, well, we're going to go and see her. Well, she's just out on a general mission. "Well, I think she's being really suspicious, so we're going up to Emery Meadows." I said, "Really?" They said, "Yeah." So I said, "Okay, so you go buy horses, you deplete your resources, you spend 2 days, you go out to Canada today, you try and find her out in Emery Meadows, you don't see her, there's no indication that she was here, so you head back, and it was a useless 2 days." "Really? How come you didn't tell us we didn't have to go?" I said, "I kind of hinted a lot that you didn't have to go." "Well, why?" Why'd you mention Emery Meadows then?" I said, "Well, because that's the first thing that came to my mind when I think the town of Hamlet, right? Not Hamlet Lane."
Yeah.
And they said, "Oh, well, that was a waste of time." So anyway, so then they decided, you know what?
That's what we call a red herring. And you get up and ate it for dinner.
Yeah, absolutely.
And they said, "Well, forget this now. We're going to the moat house." So we get to the moat house, and I guess the frustration was still there because I did a random encounter thing just for fun. And they get to the moat house, and I said, all is quiet. Nobody did a perception check or anything like that. The defender goes, "I'm charging in." "Really? Really?" And the defender goes, "Yeah, I'm charging in." "Okay, immediate interrupt. Frog jumps out of the water and attacks you." "Well, I was running." I said, "Well, he had a ready to action. As soon as you got close enough, he jumped out and attacked you." And he didn't like that. He went prone. All of a sudden, it brought everybody's attention in the moat house because he's basically doing like a battle cry, like, all the way to the moat house. And, you know, the archers had time to position themselves. My party had a really tough time with this encounter. It ended up in a TKO. Well, I made it a TKO. I'll explain that in a second.
As opposed to a TPK.
Correct. And I just went all out. They played stupidly. They played stupid tactics. So as a DM, yeah, I'm forgiving about the TKO. I'm a little forgiving that way, making it a little more interesting that way. Maybe they won't rush into combat anymore. But long and short is the archers had 2, 3, I think almost 4 rounds to set up and start shooting at the party. On top of that, the Dwarven Berserkers, I think they were called Dwarven Berserkers? Dwarven battlesmiths?
I just called them dwarves. I don't even remember what they were actually called.
Yeah, they were kick-ass and they locked down the battlefield. Excuse the expression. They really were tough. And they went out and they engaged the party and they blocked the moat house gateway. So essentially the party was getting shot at by all 8 archers. The head Edna came out and watched the party get decimated by these arrows. The dwarves lasted, what, another 5 rounds? The frogs went in the first 3. The party was really depleted on resources even before they can get into the moat house. And then we had the defender that basically raced over the moat house gate and went right into the crook of things and wanted to take down Edna, and Edna used her little dagger trick. So her dagger trick was basically stab really hard and shift away. And she was out of harm's reach. And that really threw his plans down. It put him down to negative hit points. And I just said, you know what? Battle's over. I think the rest of our guys had like 2 hit points left and 3 hit points. And yeah, so next week we're basically starting where Craig's table started this week. So it was really interesting. The minimum role-playing that we did was really fun, and it was funny because a lot of, you know, all the characters around the table were getting really hyper and excited, saying, "Oh yeah, we're gonna take out Canada today," and all that kind of stuff. Never found her. I said it was just useless. she's just not even in this module, right? So it's pretty funny. So that was long and short what happened. There was nothing spectacular about the combat. I mean, the combat was fun, but I mean, there's no spectacular feats of anything. I mean, it was so disorganized. It's kind of like watching a hockey game when your team is just skating on the ice. That's essentially what it was like, right? It was just so disorganized.
The Leafs.
Yeah.
See, that's why I cheer for the Bruins.
Yeah. So that's what it was. The combat was nothing spectacular. It was fun. Everybody had a lot of fun. Everybody had fun getting TKO'd, but it was just nothing spectacular. Nothing exciting happened.
Indeed. That's unfortunate. I mean, at least it sounds like they had fun.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
We always have a lot of fun because we always make jokes and puns and everything, right, of the characters and the NPCs and everything in the party. So I'm not too worried about them having fun or not. I was just like, you know, bad tactics, guys. I mean, you've got to go. I understand that your guy's a Warforged sword mage and you're making him kind of a mechanical, no-brainer barbarian type guy, but you know, you've got the rest of your party to consider, and you've got a whole bunch of guys you got to kill. And we had very little. We had a warlock that was a secondary role controller, but that's the closest thing we had to a controller.
Interesting. Indeed. Oh, well. And then, Craig, why don't you tell us about your second table? This was the moat house, the second part of the moat house?
That's right, yeah. Well, I'll just briefly touch on it, but basically, I didn't talk about my first attempt at the moat house last week, but so we played the situation that that Mark, you were just talking about, and my party also wiped on it. Did not go so well. We were knocked out, and a couple of the guys were given a chance to surrender, which, you know, they did. And basically, they robbed us blind and said, you know what, you guys, the guys downstairs are really weird, so we're taking off. So if you want to come back here and you know, deal with your crap here, that's fine. But, you know, we're robbing you of your stuff. We're taking your money or whatever, and we're jumping town. So we were allowed to return back to the village of Homelane at the end of last week, and this week we had decided to return.
I can just picture your party walking back into town and basically in their underwear and their boots.
Yeah, it's basically what it was like. they did tell us that there's two people in town that know the password to get into the downstairs, and they're like, you know, and trust us, the guys down there are crazier than us. Like, it's a whole different level with those guys. So if you gotta settle, it's gonna be with those guys, and you come back and do it. But in the meantime, get the hell out of here, right? But we're not exactly in a position to argue. So we made our way back. We did find out, you know, well, the password is this, and blah blah blah. We refitted ourselves with our equipment. Now we decided that we weren't going to rest before. The rest of the party really wanted to get there before. They wanted to try and head those bandits off before they were able to skip town. But, of course, you know, by the time we got there, it appeared the bandits had just taken off pretty well as soon as they sent us on our way. So they were gone, so we made our way into the basement. And we did, however, manage to get ourselves several pairs of the cultist robes. So we came in and we found out there's this cult operating underneath. You come right into it, and we were able to pass through some of the guard checkpoints and get right into the leader of these cultists, and watched as he, like, had this ritual that summoned the Miska, the wolf spider. So we got our first taste of that part of the storyline, and the ritual was completed. We brought back out, and they decided they were going to start to assess us, see how useful we are. And the rune priest in our party had decided that when they asked him, what can you bring to the team? His choice of words is like, well, I'm a rune priest, you see? And that didn't go over too well because, they're not too too pleased with having a rune priest.
Tolerant of other religions?
yeah, exactly. So he realized this as he was saying it. He's like, oh, maybe I shouldn't say that. So, the DM running the table that night, said, all right, well, do a bluff. I'll let it go if you can pass the bluff check, which he, rolled horribly on. So that was it. Combat was on. And unfortunately, we were pretty well dead center, surrounded by all of the way they were placed, because you had a couple of the minions in beds. You had the minion guards up at the other side of the hall. And then you had the two guards in front of the leader's room as well as the leader, just perfectly surrounding us. When it came into time for combat, this is where we really suffered for not having a controller. The minions just swooped in. I mean, like we were saying before, they have their fixed damage, but another big problem is that they also help provide a combat advantage. So they softened us up quite a bit with just five damage here, five damage here, five damage there. There's tons of minions in this particular encounter, as well as the big guys hit pretty freaking hard.
That was one thing that we talked about a little bit earlier was, I'm really enjoying these encounters, but it seems that the monsters, especially like the non-minion guys, they really do a lot of damage.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, Lareth the Beautiful, the big leader of the of this cult, had a burst 5 or a blast 5 that did, he ended up rolling 19 damage on anyone who got hit. And it pushed us all back. So we had, our rune priest had this effect on that, gave us all a boost to our defenses while we're adjacent to him, as well as reducing some of the damage. So of course, when he split us apart, he sent the rune priest in a completely different direction. So we were now no longer receiving this boon, and it was just a mess after that. So they softened us up. We did eventually take care of the minions, but because we weren't able to get a control with a controller on that situation earlier, like we were already too soft by the time it came down to just focusing on sort of like the big bads of the situation, and then they took us out once again. So second TPK, but he kind of took a similar approach to what Mark was talking about, where we were knocked out. I mean this is really early in the night too, so it was kind of like, oh crap, we're done. So we were knocked out. We were held back in the moat house again. We woke up and found ourselves tied, and we would overhear a conversation of, well, let's bring them to the Golden Grain Inn and let's have them transferred over to the temple to be processed. And he was tying it into the reptile god thing. So we ended up getting placed on a cart by the two guards that were guarding Lair the Beautiful's lair. And on the way down, we decided to, because we were able to break free of our restraints earlier, so we decided to launch an attack at that time. So he made it sort of an on-the-fly skill challenge as opposed to another combat. So the goal of our skill challenge, we wanted to get back to Laerith's lair because they were planning an attack on the city and all this stuff. So we wanted to get back there and try and put a stop to it. But unfortunately, we did not pass the skill challenge. Still very close, one success away from actually accomplishing what we needed to, but we failed. We ended up getting lost, not being able to find our way back to the moat house. So we ended up back in town, and we just decided to warn everyone, this is what's coming, this is what's coming. And there's a lot of concern. Windell decided to move his family out of the town for the time being because he didn't want them to be hurt. But he did outfit us with gear again, because once again, we found ourselves without equipment. As well, what else happened? Oh, that's right. A couple of the guys went to the Temple of the Lawbringer, who's like, you know, hey, why don't you guys go to the Golden Grain Inn? We'll pay. You guys have done the town a great service. You know, it's on us. You go ahead and have yourself a nice extended rest over there, and, you know, you'll be all rested up, and, you know, you can come back to the town's aid. And, of course, knowing what happens in the Golden Grain Inn, of course, I know this is where we're sort of being led to start the next path. So we do the group's sort of unanimous decision was, why don't we check out, because he gave us a description of the inns. We wanted to find out, well, you know, what inns are in town and where is this processing happening? What the hell's going on? So the description was, you know, you have the Golden Grain Inn, you have the Slumbering Dragon, I believe, or Slumbering Serpent, sorry. And
Slumbering
then
Serpent, yeah.
And then the other one, the crap, what's the one that's all busted up called?
The Wench.
Yeah, that's right. The Whispering Wench, that's it. So that's the one, of course, I piped in like, hey, you know what? If cultists are making plans and they need to process people and do sorts of weird things, that sounds like that's the place. Obviously, knowing full well that it's not. But so all the players are like, yeah, absolutely, for sure. That's what I was thinking. So let's absolutely do that. So let's go to the Golden Grain Inn. Let's have a nice sleep, and we'll get up. We'll get ourselves all collected. We'll ask around at the tavern at the Golden Grain Inn to see if anyone knows anything about the Whispering Wench and see what kind of information we can glean. Then we can go in there at night and just totally, like, disrupt the cult's activities there. So that's where we ended. But he actually brought it right up to, like, we get to the Golden Grain Inn. We go to sleep. We have our extended rest. But when we come down, one of the PCs was missing.
Ah, interesting.
But it worked out well because the PC that was missing had already told us he wasn't going to be able to attend the next session.
Oh, that's awesome.
So it actually worked out rather well that he had this sort of idea planted ahead of time.
Nice.
So, yeah, no, it went well. He did a lot of, like, on-the-fly thinking when the combat ended abruptly and early. So there's a lot of stuff that wasn't really part of the encounter that had to be thrown in and tied together. And I thought it actually flowed really well.
Very cool.
It's good. It's fun.
No, I always find it's interesting when DMs make changes like that. Because, I mean, Craig, obviously, you've read the adventure, so you knew sort of what was what. But nobody else at the table knew what the DM was making up and what was in the adventure. As far as they knew, everything was running exactly as the adventure had planned out. And, I mean, that's a sign of a really good DM, is the players have no idea what's on script and off script. And even you, who knew what was scripted and not scripted, sort of walked away going, you know what, it worked. You tied it together nicely. I mean, that's a good job by the DM to be able to do that. Especially, like, that's not necessarily something you anticipate. But believe me, now that I've heard it happen, I'm going to try and use something along those lines if the group I'm running suffers in a TPK between now and the end of the encounter.
Yeah, seriously, after all these stories of what, you know, what people have been doing, and like the fact that you guys went to the Caves of Chaos and decided not to go back to the round two of the Moat House, like, I don't know, it just, it seems like, okay, so it's that open, we can do that, and it makes sense, you know what I mean? It's not too much of a stretch to actually do this. But yeah.
So it sounds like everybody's just kind of taking all sorts of paths all over the way. It's been a very interesting season so far.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think, too, another thing to mention, too, in the Southern Ontario region anyway, I'm not sure how far up this weather's going, but it's been really cruddy weather today. So I think we were initially concerned we were going to have really low numbers, might have to combine tables tonight. But I don't know. I kind of think it speaks to the quality of this module. We had very minimal casualties in that regard. I felt like we still had a full three tables, right?
That's good. You guys are learning to actually get through the weather.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not only did we have good numbers. I know I had a brand new player at my table, and Craig, correct me if I'm wrong. Did you not have a brand new player at your table again tonight?
No, we didn't have. We were actually short just one.
And I was short one of my regulars, but I had a brand new player show up to fill in the seat. So I ran a table of five. The other table that neither of us played at, I believe, had a party of six. And how many were at your table this week? Four, five,
four.
So, yeah, we ended up with three DMs and 15 players, which, yeah, I think, Craig, you hit it right on the head. Is the players who are playing it are enjoying it to the point where, you know, a little bit of snow is not going to stop them.
Yeah, exactly. Whereas, and we both know in the past, you know, very poor weather can sometimes keep people at home. So,
yeah, I mean, we're not talking like crazy snow like Boston was getting there a little while back.
Yeah,
like,
sure.
Obviously, they had to cancel everything. But yeah, I mean, you know, we had a decent amount of snow, but yeah.
I guess a few people
not show up.
Yeah, I should put that just in terms that I fully understand if anyone's listening to this, you know, outside of Ontario, anywhere else in Canada, basically laughing about, oh, poor Toronto with their, like, minimal snow. Yes, I completely realize this, but...
Did the military boys show up to play?
Oh, there we go. Yeah, that took 10 seconds.
they were on call.
Yeah.
Indeed.
Well, I was there for the 99 snow, so don't worry.
Yeah, fair enough. I mean, it's. I think it's overall thus far, like, every week has been great.
Yeah,
it's been really interesting to see where everyone's been going with it, and everyone seems to be having a great time. That's the common thread, I think, through all the groups, is that everyone's having fun, even with you have little trouble. Like I said, with the one I was running this week with the sort of tacked on encounter, but I think that combat was a lot of fun. It felt pretty varied, and it was like a different kind of scenario that, and knowing that the table next to you isn't doing that same thing.
One thing I noticed as a DM for me is I find that the adventure is it's structured enough to give guidance to almost anybody who needs the structure,
yeah.
But yet flexible enough for other people to make the necessary changes that they want to make without actually changing the overall story.
Right.
I love
exactly. That. Yeah, it's really well written, so. And I mean, I completely agree, right? Like, they provide structure where, you know, it might be needed, or, you know, where they think it's going to be beneficial, but there's also so much room to move it around and make it your own.
So kudos to Sean and kudos to James, and way to go, guys. It's seems to be another hit so far this season.
Absolutely. What about you guys? Do you have any other, cause I've already talked a little bit about the issue that I had with my particular encounter. Do anyone have any issues or any sort of like tips or things to watch out for?
Not in this encounter. Like I said, the only thing I had last week was the spacing for the ogre and stuff, and I think Derek fixed that a little bit, gave him a little bit of a heads up, and yeah, so it seems to have worked that kink out, but nothing this week for me.
And what about you?
The only challenge that I've found so far is, especially with a lot of newer players at my table, is the multitude of options available to them early in the adventure is creating a little bit of confusion, you know, because it's not just you go from point A to point B to point C to point D. I'm trying to present them with options without guiding them too strongly in one direction or the other. And unfortunately for me, one of the players at my table is one of the DMs at the other store. So he's intentionally taking a back seat to the decision making because he doesn't want to influence, you know, if he knows something's coming up, he doesn't want to ruin that surprise by saying, oh no, let's not go here until we're more powerful. So the other players at the table, I find are struggling a little bit with, well, what do we do? And you know, I found, especially with this week, I had to basically, on more than one occasion, spell it out. Like, okay, this is what you know. X, Y, Z. These are the options that seem to be apparent based on what you know. And so I, you know, I say, I'm like, and we've go, you know, we'd go around the table. I'm like, well, what do you think? If you had to vote on one of these two paths, which one do you think your character would be more likely to do? And I mean, I hate to sort of pressure the players like that, but you know, we had some role playing. I had some exposition where I had the various NPCs give them information, but by then we were 45 minutes into it. And I thought, you know, it's going to be at least another 10 minutes before we get into the sort of the combat side of it. Let's just get it going. And, you know, again, I sort of talked to the players a little bit afterwards to get some feedback from them. And, you know, they all seemed to think that that it was okay the way it was handled. But that's sort of my only, I mean, it's both a plus and a minus. The experienced players love that flexibility. Mm-hmm. The rookie players aren't really sure what to do with it. So, you know, you just have to get a gauge for your table. And as the DM, you know, sort of guide them where you think they need it. And, you know, play to the table play to the players that are at your table.
Yeah, for sure. Just to kind of recognize who needs what.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. Indeed.
Good job. So nothing else to talk about?
All good.
Yeah, I think we covered it.
Excellent. So this concludes, I guess we'll start calling it week 3 of D&D Encounters Season 12 Against the Cult of Chaos.
You can follow me on Twitter at @Amaron_DM, and be sure to visit dungeonsmaster.com for original D&D 4th edition material, including a weekly field report of my D&D encounters experiences.
And follow me on Twitter at 20foot, and visit 20footradius.blogspot.com for your weekly dose of D&D encounters. That's 20footradius20ftradius.blogspot.com. Until then, have a blast.